Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. U.S. President Donald Trump said Thursday that he's confident Russian President Vladimir Putin will not push to restart the war in Ukraine if a truce is reached, AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
In the Oval Office,
I think he'll keep his word.
The president says he's known Putin for a long time and does not believe Putin will go back on his word.
History must be on the side of the peacemaker, not the invader.
The president spoke alongside British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the second European leader to visit the White House this week, amid concerns on the continent about the president perhaps conceding too much to Putin in an aggressive push to end the war. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visits the White House on Friday. Zelensky and Trump are expected to sign off on a contentious agreement that would give the U.S. access to Ukraine's critical minerals. Egypt says negotiations between Israel and Hamas on the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire have begun in Cairo. Egypt's State Information Service said officials from Israel, Qatar, and the U.S. on Thursday started intensive discussions on the second phase of the ceasefire. An Israeli official had said earlier in the day that Israel's military will not withdraw from a strategic corridor in the Gaza Strip. The pullout was part of the ceasefire, and Israel's refusal could spark a crisis with Hamas and key mediator Egypt at a sensitive moment for a fragile truce. The Israeli official spoke hours after Hamas released the remains of four hostages in exchange for over 600 Palestinian prisoners, the last planned exchange of the ceasefire's first phase, which ends this weekend. This is VOA News. Top officials from the U.S. and several other member states skipped the group of 20 major economies finance ministers meeting in South Africa this week, raising questions about the group's continued relevance. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
The two-day meeting in Cape Town ended without a communique, with current G20 leader South Africa saying there was not sufficient consensus to issue one. In his opening remarks at the event, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa referred to the fractured geopolitical climate and stressed the importance of international cooperation.
At this time of global uncertainty and escalating tension, it is now more important than ever that the members of the G20 should work together.
But it appeared the world's largest economies were not able to find common ground on a number of issues. The finance ministers' meeting was beset with similar problems faced by last week's G20 foreign ministers' meeting in Johannesburg, which laid bare the discord in current geopolitics. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent skipped the event amid a spat with host country South Africa and after the U.S. criticized the themes around climate change and solidarity, equality, and sustainability. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
President Trump said on Thursday that his proposed 25% tariffs on Mexican and Canadian goods will go into effect on March 4th and threaten an extra 10% duty on Chinese imports over what he said were drugs pouring into the U.S. from those countries. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Canadian and Mexican officials were due to meet with Trump administration counterparts in Washington on Thursday and Friday to try to forestall the tariffs, which could deal a serious blow to a highly integrated North American economy. Trump's comments on the matter during his first cabinet meeting on Wednesday seemed to suggest that he may push the deadline back for about 1 month until April 4th.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. A search warrant shows that Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman, his wife, and one of their dogs had been dead for some time before being discovered. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
A maintenance worker entered the couple's Santa Fe, New Mexico home Wednesday and found their bodies. They say one of their dogs, a German Shepherd, was found dead in the bathroom closet. But two other dogs, one inside the home and one outside, were found alive and well. A sheriff's detective says the couple didn't have any wounds and that there were no signs of a carbon monoxide leak or carbon monoxide poisoning. I'm Donna Warder.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Prime Minister Starmer visits President Trump.
We agree history must be on the side of the peacemaker, not the invader. So the stakes, they couldn't be higher.
Many in Russia are looking to warmer relations with the United States.
Trump's promises to end the war and invitation to Russia, but not Ukraine, at peace negotiations has sparked enthusiasm here for a reset.
And a visit to Johannesburg for the G20.
At this time of global uncertainty and escalating tension, it is now more important than ever that the members of the G20 should work together. The erosion of multilateralism presents a threat to global growth and stability.
Today is Friday, February 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. Our top story today comes from right here in Washington. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer is in town to visit with US President Donald Trump. They met Thursday afternoon at the White House and discussed the war in Ukraine and security guarantees for Kyiv, as well as transatlantic trade and other bilateral issues. VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell has more.
U.S. President Donald Trump and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the leaders of two nations that formed a special relationship while pushing Nazis and fascists off the battlefields of World War II, met Thursday at the White House to discuss the looming threat, 8 decades later, of war in Europe as Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine enters a fourth year. Trump emphasized his condition for supporting Ukraine. On Friday, he said he will host Ukraine's president to lay out a preliminary deal that gives the U.S. a share of the nation's critical raw materials.
The American taxpayers will now effectively be reimbursed for the money and hundreds of billions of dollars poured into helping Ukraine defend itself, which by and of itself is a very worthy thing to do.
Starmer said the pair discussed a plan for peace that is tough but fair and backed by strength to deter future Russian aggression. He also said he was ready to put boots on the ground and planes in the air to support a deal. And in answer to Trump's demand that NATO members boost defense spending to 5% of GDP, Starmer said he agreed Europe had to step up. Earlier in the week, he announced an unexpected increase that still falls far short of Trump's benchmark. He also set his conditions for a fair settlement.
It can't be peace that rewards the aggressor or that gives encouragement to regimes like Iran. We agree history must be on the side of the peacemaker, not the invader. So the stakes, they couldn't be higher. And we're determined to work together to deliver a good deal.
Unity is key, analysts say, but there will be challenges. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The most important thing, do these guys get along? Do they have a common vision? Can they maintain some sense of common purpose? Can they avoid the kind of divisive rhetoric that President Trump used a lot last week when he was so pejorative towards President Zelensky of Ukraine? And can we begin to see a Western strategy really emerging that all major countries in NATO can agree to?
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin, who spent his day at the Kremlin hosting a high-ranking North Korean delegation, rejects the idea of peacekeepers in Ukraine. South Korea's spy agency reported Thursday that Pyongyang appears to have sent additional troops to assist Russia on Ukraine's battlefields. Putin said Thursday that there is a mutual readiness for Moscow and Washington to further cooperate after Trump recently reached out directly. He also blamed Western elites for trying to disrupt the blossoming relationship. Trump has said they will meet in Saudi Arabia, but has set no date. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
And along with the U.S.-UK relationship, the U.S.-Russia relationship has been under scrutiny lately as the U.S. has softened its stance on its longtime foe. Anticipation is growing in Russia for a summit, though it's yet to be scheduled, between U.S. President Trump and President Vladimir Putin of Russia. On the streets of Moscow, many Russians welcome what they see as a thaw in relations with Washington and what some hope is the beginning of the end of their country's isolation from the West. Jonathan Speier narrates this report.
The Russian leadership pays tribute to those who have died in these 3 years of full-scale war in Ukraine. Now entering its fourth year, Russia still calls it a special military operation, and they're marking it with events including an exhibit of portraits of the fallen. But it's the anticipation of a face-to-face meeting between Trump and Putin that's dominating the conversation on the streets of Moscow. Maxim Ilyunov is among the artists taking part in the Memorial Portrait exhibit. He sees Trump's approach as transactional and a positive thing.
Trump always says, let's make a deal. It's a business position, and those who make deals do not waste advantages, but they seek to acquire. One can negotiate with him, but he wants money, not bullets.
Relations between Moscow and Washington hit a low point due to then-President Joe Biden's political and military support for Ukraine. Trump's promises to end the war and invitation to Russia, but not Ukraine, at peace negotiations has sparked enthusiasm here for a reset. But that enthusiasm is tempered by some voices calling for lowered expectations. Alexei Gromko directs the Institute of Europe at the Russian Academy of Science. He spoke at a conference hosted by the Russian state news agency RIA Novosti.
We remember Trump's first presidency when, in general, massive sanctions began to be imposed against our country as never before. Increased arms supplies to Ukraine began. Much was done to worsen the situation around the Ukrainian crisis and in relations between Moscow and Washington at that time.
Russians who oppose their country's invasion of Ukraine have been silenced in Russia or forced into exile. They see Trump's proposed negotiations as a de facto political and military victory for Putin. Anton Barbashin is editorial director at Riddle Russia, an organization based in Germany that brings together a diverse group of Putin opponents living in exile.
Russia would really like to have working relations with the United States, provided that Russian interests will be taken into account in Ukraine. This is, in fact, Putin's rather ambitious plan, which is no different from the capitulation of Ukraine.
On the streets of Moscow, the general opinion is that with Trump, a door has opened that was impossible under Biden.
Trump is a more reasonable person, more reasonable, pragmatic. And his entourage, and Elon Musk, and all of them, they are smart people.
There's no room for negotiation with Biden. He hid the truth and had personal interests in Ukraine.
In general, to be honest, I don't care. We will win. I don't care about America. I don't care about Europe.
Many Russians say they want to see an end to the war in Ukraine, and they see Trump's overtures as the channel to a peace agreement they hope will end not only the war, but also sanctions and Russia's isolation. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Jonathan Speer, VOA News.
And turning now to the ongoing conflict in eastern Congo. There was a deadly explosion Thursday in Bukavu, which was recently captured by rebels. Rebel leaders blame the Congolese president Felix Tshisekedi for the uptick in violence. Sean Hogan of Reuters has that story.
Explosions killed more than 10 people and wounded dozens at a rally held by M23 rebels in the eastern Congo city of Bukavu on Thursday, the leader of the rebel alliance said. M23 leader Cornel Nanga blamed President Felix Tshisekedi for the violence and said at a press conference grenades were used in the attack. Reuters could not independently verify this. People ran through Bukavu streets carrying the wounded as gunfire and explosions reportedly rang out at a mass rally held by Nanga. Congo's presidency said on X there were several deaths and blamed a foreign army illegally present on Congolese soil. Nanga's M23 rebel group has battled Congo's army and seized swaths of territory in the east since the beginning of the year. Congo, the United Nations, and Western powers say neighboring Rwanda is backing the group, accusations Rwanda denies. The rebel advance has stirred fears of a regional war that could draw in Congo's neighbors. In a speech before the shooting started, Nanga told a crowd of thousands they had come to Bukavu to bring security, with an intention to expel what he called thieves and bandits from other areas in a few days. M23 has been trying to demonstrate it can restore order in the territory it has captured from Congo's army and has reopened ports and schools. It is the gravest escalation in more than a decade in eastern Congo, rooted in the spillover of Rwanda's 1994 genocide into Congo.
That was Sean Hogan of Reuters reporting. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Negotiations between Israel and Hamas on the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire began Thursday in Cairo, Egypt said, averting a collapse of the truce ahead of Saturday's expiration of the agreement's first phase. Officials from Israel, Qatar, and the United States started intensive discussions on the ceasefire accord's second phase, this according to Egypt's State Information Service. The mediators are also discussing ways to enhance the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip, it said. China has held a series of live-fire military drills across the Indo-Pacific region over the past week, from the Taiwan Strait to the Tasman Sea. Analysts say the exercises, which included extremely capable weapon systems, were aimed at testing the U.S. and regional countries' responses to military threats. Taiwanese authorities said the unannounced drills posed threats to commercial flights and shipping. Katy Perry and Gayle King are headed to space with Jeff Bezos' fiancée, Lauren Sanchez, and three other women. Bezos' rocket company Blue Origin announced the all-female celebrity crew will blast off sometime this spring aboard a new Shepard rocket for a 10-minute spaceflight. Blue Origin has flown tourists on short hops to space since 2021. It's not immediately known who's paying the bill for this upcoming flight. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. In American politics, Elon Musk and his team at the Department of Government Efficiency continue to be one of the most controversial elements of President Trump's new administration. During the first cabinet meeting of his second term on Wednesday, President Trump defended his administration's moves to cut waste and reduce the size of the U.S. government workforce. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports on the impact of those actions and pushback coming from fired federal workers and Democratic leaders.
Flanked by his new cabinet members, President Donald Trump defended his administration's major cuts in government spending, saying he has a mandate from voters.
I got elected based on taxes and based on many things in the border, but also based on balancing budgets and getting our country back into shape, and this is a big part of it.
Trump praised Elon Musk's swift efforts to reduce government fraud and waste. At Wednesday's cabinet meeting, the tech billionaire told reporters that his Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, needs to move quickly to achieve a $1 trillion deficit reduction by fiscal year 2026.
So it requires saving $4 billion per day, every day, from now through the end of September. We'll make mistakes. We won't be perfect, but when we make a mistake, we'll fix it very quickly.
Union leaders and Democrats in Congress oppose shutting down entire government agencies and the administration's goal to slash the federal workforce of about 2.4 million civilian employees. Democratic Minority Leader in the U.S. Senate, Chuck Schumer.
You don't use a blowtorch, you don't use a meat axe and cut all the good things as well as things that are waste, fraud, and abuse. No smart businessman would do that. And I think what they're doing is just outrageous. It's hurting people.
Political scientist Jonathan Hansen weighed in on the impact of DOGE measures. He spoke via Skype.
The efforts to date seem to be dramatic moves that are unlikely to have major cost savings in the short term and will be harmful to government capacity in the long run.
So far, the cuts don't seem to have hurt Trump politically. Political scientist Kyle Kondik told VOA via Skype.
I don't think that the reaction has been overwhelmingly negative, because I think if it was, Donald Trump's approval rating would already be, you know, lower than it actually is right now. And I think the idea of spending cuts in the abstract are actually fairly popular.
He added, the question will be how Americans react over the course of several months to potential disruptions of government services they are used to benefiting from. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Along with the shrinking size and scope of the federal government, President Trump also campaigned on instituting trade tariffs on imported goods, even those coming from allies. As Alex Cohen of Reuters tells us, they're supposed to start next week.
U.S. President Donald Trump said on Thursday that his proposed 25% tariffs on Mexican and Canadian goods will go into effect on March 4th as scheduled, because of what he said were drugs flowing into the U.S. from those countries.
The drugs continue to pour into our country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. We're losing substantially more than 100,000 people. I mean, dead. They're dead. The families are destroyed after that happens.
Trump also said he would impose an additional 10% duty on Chinese goods on that day.
It's 10 plus 10. Okay. Was there confusion on that?
There was, sir, yeah.
Okay, 10 plus 10. It's a second 10.
Canadian and Mexican officials were due to meet with Trump administration counterparts in Washington on Thursday and Friday to try to forestall the tariffs, which could deal a serious blow to a highly integrated North American economy. Here's Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum.
The goal is to protect the trade treaty between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada, and within this frame, see what actions to take to strengthen the three economies. So Mexican ministers in Washington have studied the matters thoroughly, and there have been previous discussions. So I hope we can reach an agreement, and on March 4th, we can announce another thing.
Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said his country will have an immediate and extremely strong response if the U.S. imposes tariffs next week.
We will continue to do that work and do everything necessary to avoid these tariffs coming in. But like I said, if on Tuesday there are unjustified tariffs brought in on Canada, we will have an immediate and extremely strong response, as Canadians expect.
Beijing, in a letter to U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer, said China and the United States should address concerns in economic and trade fields through equal dialogue and consultation.
It's Reuters' Alex Cohen. In other domestic news, a bill that would strip gender identity protections from the Civil Rights Code in the state of Iowa has received final legislative approval and now goes to the governor. Iowa legislators approved the final version of the bill on Thursday. Hundreds of LGBTQ plus advocates who opposed the bill gathered at the Capitol to resist. They say the change would expose transgender people to discrimination in all areas of life. The bill now goes to the Republican governor, Kim Reynolds, who has been supportive of efforts to limit gender identity protection. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts on Wednesday paused a lower court judge's order requiring President Trump's administration to pay foreign aid funds to contractors and grant recipients. Jillian Kitchener of Reuters has that story.
Chief Justice John Roberts has allowed the Trump administration to freeze foreign aid for now. A federal judge had given the government until midnight on Wednesday to pay foreign aid funds to contractors. The Trump administration said in a Wednesday court filing that it could not meet that deadline. Roberts provided no rationale for the order, known as an administrative stay. It will give the Supreme Court additional time to consider the Trump administration's more formal request to block the federal judge's ruling. Trump ordered a 90-day pause on all foreign aid in January. His administration is cutting more than 90% of the U.S. Agency for International Development's foreign aid contracts, according to a State Department spokesperson, and over $58 billion in overall U.S. assistance around the world. Aid organizations had filed lawsuits alleging that the agencies have illegally frozen all foreign aid payments. The cuts, part of Trump's America First agenda, have jeopardized the delivery of life-saving food and medical aid, throwing global humanitarian relief efforts into chaos.
That's Jillian Kitchener of Reuters reporting for us. The group of 20 major economies has been instrumental in coordinating the response to global crises like the COVID pandemic. But top officials from the U.S. and several other member states skipped the G20 finance ministers' meeting in South Africa this week, raising questions about the group's continued relevance in a splintered global environment. Kate Bartlett has our story from Johannesburg.
The two-day meeting in Cape Town ended without a communique, with current G20 leader South Africa saying there was not sufficient consensus to issue one. In his opening remarks at the event, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa referred to the fractured geopolitical climate and stressed the importance of international cooperation.
At this time of global uncertainty and escalating tension, it is now more important than ever that the members of the G20 should work together. The erosion of multilateral capitalism presents a threat to global growth and stability.
He said the G20 finance ministers meeting had to address major issues like climate change financing, ensuring debt sustainability for developing countries, and Africa's need to process its own critical minerals for inclusive growth. But it appeared the world's largest economies were not able to find common ground on a number of issues. South African Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana noted this wasn't the first time.
The issue of the communique and the absence thereof is not something new.
Climate adaptation funding was one of the areas where there was a difference of opinion, he said. The finance ministers' meeting was beset with similar problems faced by last week's G20 foreign ministers' meeting in Johannesburg, which laid bare the discord in current geopolitics. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent skipped the event amid a spat with host country South Africa and after the U.S. criticized the themes around climate change and solidarity, equality, and sustainability. The finance chiefs of other large economies, including Japan, India, and China, also sat it out. However, all of them, including the U.S., sent representation at various levels. Still, the absence of some top officials underscores global divisions sparked by Russia's attack on Ukraine and the America First administration of U.S. President Trump, said Professor Alex Vandenheffer.
And I think that this has caused a sort of a general review of how people see global issues, with people becoming a lot more insular and not really looking at sort of global social solidarity in any way of shape or form, largely looking to look after their own situation.
However, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, who was in Cape Town for the meeting, added to Ramaphosa's call for unity, posting on social media platform X, quote, "productive and successful collaboration with our international partners is front of mind now more than ever." And asked about the issue of tariffs, Godongwana said there had been, quote, "general agreement against protectionism" at the G20 meeting. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Special Agent Clint Hill, a member of the Secret Service detail assigned to protect President John F. Kennedy on the day he was assassinated in Dallas, has died at age 93. VOA's Kane Farabaugh, who interviewed Hill several times over the years, has our story.
Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
When shots rang out in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, the cameras capturing the moments of the assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy all showed one man springing into action.
I was the only one that had a chance to do anything, and I was unable to do it. And that stayed with me, has stayed with me the rest of my life.
Clint Hill was the Secret Service agent on the back of the presidential limousine transporting the president and First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy as the motorcade made its way through Dealey Plaza. In interviews with Voice of America, Hill shared his eyewitness account of those fateful days in Texas.
I can remember it just as if it's a newsreel running out in front of me.
Hill admitted the assassination still haunted him.
It ate at me. It got worse and worse.
But not at first. In the immediate aftermath, Hill was busy protecting Jacqueline Kennedy and her children before returning to the White House detail. Hill said as long as he was working, he could keep his mind off the assassination, until a promotion in 1970 within the Secret Service led to a desk job.
It gave me the chance to just sit and think. And the more I thought, the worse it got. The deeper the emotions became. And I started to spiral downward.
A few years later, Hill's marriage ended. He eventually retired from the Secret Service with a medical disability.
I feel guilt. I feel responsibility. I was the only agent who was in a position to do anything that day.
It took Clint Hill nearly 50 years to open up about the assassination.
I heard an explosive noise from the right rear.
Writing and promoting several books across the country were a part of the healing process.
It's been very cathartic, and especially being able to go out and talk to the people about the book, answer it, a lot of the questions that they have, because there are still a lot of questions out there.
Including questions about what happened that day in Dallas. Hill says he believes that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin.
There are so many different conspiracies out there, and they are so phony that it's hard to even discuss them.
Clint Hill passed away February 21st at his home in California. He was 93. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.